KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If the United States decides to raise its tariff basically just to match another country's tariff, that country doesn't just sit there idle and say, we'll agree to that.
President Trump is threatening more tariffs. Could it start tit-for-tat trade wars?
Today is Thursday, February 13th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Newly released Palestinian prisoners say they are now being harassed by Israeli forces.
Those that they released, they could rearrest them again.
Meanwhile, many Palestinians who fled to Syria in 1948 are still waiting to return home. Now they're telling people in Gaza not to leave.
And a Saturday Night Live celebrates 50 years on air. We look at the people backstage who bring the characters to life.
It's just a flurry of hands. We don't stop. That's one of my things. I zone out and don't talk much when I'm in doing my makeup.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. President Trump met with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi at the White House today, discussing efforts to strengthen defense and economic ties. But as NPR's Asma Khalid reports, it came on the same day Trump announced reciprocal tariffs on countries around the world, including India.
The Trump administration says these new tariffs would not be ready until April at the earliest. But it is certainly significant for trade relations. Trump has repeatedly singled India out for its high tariff rates on U.S. imports. At his joint press conference with his Indian counterpart, Trump put it this way.
I had discussions with India in the first term about the fact that their tariffs were very high, and I was unable to get a concession. So we're just going to do it the easy way, and we're just going to say whatever you charge, we charge.
The president also said that India's prime minister has agreed to begin negotiations over long-running trade disparities with the goal of signing an agreement. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
A federal judge has extended for another week the pause on the Trump administration's plan to put thousands of federal employees of the U.S. Agency for International Development on paid leave. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports another ruling on that controversial plan is expected next week.
For now, the Trump administration is still blocked from putting more than 2,000 USAID workers on leave. U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols is now set to decide whether that continues past February 21st. That uncertainty is wreaking havoc among many USAID employees, especially those stationed overseas, says Susan Reichle, a retired senior career officer for the agency.
People are living in fear because it's not as though they come home and they have a house to return to and their kids automatically go into a school. They have no idea what their future holds.
In court, the Trump administration argues it's conducting a review of USAID's work to make sure it's aligned with Trump's foreign policy. But its challengers say the administration is overstepping its limited authority over an independent federal agency created by Congress. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, Washington.
Scores of early career federal employees are being fired from several agencies today, including the Department of Energy. NPR's Jeff Brumfield has more.
Two officials at the Energy Department confirmed the firings to NPR. They spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak to the press. The firings are of so-called probationary employees who have worked for less than 2 years in the federal government. According to one of the sources, the employees are being fired without notice or severance. The Energy Department conducts a wide variety of activities, everything from funding renewables to carrying out fundamental science to maintaining the nation's nuclear weapons. A spokesperson did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. All three major indices up around 0.1%. This is NPR. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been sworn in as the Secretary of Health and Human Services after being confirmed by the Senate today. That was over fierce opposition from Democrats, though, over his views on vaccines, and from the right over his past views on abortion. The department handles Medicaid and Medicare, popular programs that insure around 140 million Americans. He will also oversee vaccine policy, and Kennedy is one of the country's most prominent vaccine opponents. Africa's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the freeze in U.S. foreign assistance is hurting efforts to control the spread of Mpox in Africa. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel has more.
The U.S. had helped the Democratic Republic of Congo with their Mpox response by funding things like the training of health workers and the provision of diagnostic kits. Ngashi Ngongo, with Africa CDC, says the U.S. used to pay for suspected Mpox samples to be securely transported from clinics to the lab, but no longer. And he's seeing a steep drop in the number of samples making it to the lab for testing.
We are scaling up the equipment for laboratory capacity, but the transportation of samples has become a nightmare.
In addition to the funding freeze, rebel violence at the epicenter of the outbreak in eastern DRC has hurt Mpox control efforts. Gabriella Emmanuel, NPR News.
Wall Street was higher by the closing bell, the Dow up 342 points, the NASDAQ up 295. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
On a Thursday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump is threatening more tariffs. Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office this afternoon, Trump suggested that the U.S. could raise taxes on imports from other countries to match the levies that those countries charge on products from the U.S. The president says that would give a boost to American producers.
We're going to have great jobs, jobs for everybody. This is something that should have been done many years ago.
But it's not that simple. And NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now to discuss some of the wrinkles. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
All right, so we've already seen a flurry of tariffs from President Trump. What is this latest proposal?
Yeah, the president's instructing his aides to come up with a plan to match the higher tariffs that other countries are charging and to go after countries that use methods other than tariffs to make life difficult for U.S. exporters. For example, the White House noted that the European Union taxes imported cars at a higher rate than the U.S. does. Mm-hmm. Other countries also put strict limits on some U.S. farm products. Now, none of these are new complaints, but previous presidents have tried to level the playing field by urging those other countries to lower their trade barriers. Trump is flipping the script and calling instead for higher trade barriers here at home.
There could be some short-term disturbance, but long-term, it's gonna make our country a fortune.
At least some of the cost of any higher tariffs would likely be passed on to U.S. consumers, though, and this at a time when the country is already wrestling with stubborn inflation.
Yeah, so I'm confused. What exactly is the goal of these higher tariffs, then?
The White House is sending mixed signals. One argument that the administration is making is that these tariffs are a short-term tactic to get other countries to open their markets up to U.S. exports. Trump has also talked about using tariffs as a way to raise money for the government and possibly offset some of the cost of the tax cuts he also hopes to pass. The thing is, tariffs can't really do both those things. Either they're a bargaining chip that would we hope to remove pretty quickly, or they're a revenue raiser that you plan on keeping around for a while. Chad Bown, who is a trade economist at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says whatever the initial intent, tariffs often take on a life of their own.
History tells us that once tariffs go up, they're oftentimes very difficult to get them lowered again because folks get used to it. There's then economic forces in place and lobbying in place that can work against getting those tariffs removed.
And domestic companies that rely on tariffs to protect their turf don't have as much incentive to invent and invest and become better competitors in the world market.
Right. Okay. Well, then if these new tariffs do go into effect, what would be the timeline?
A study is set to be finished by April 1st, but aides say tariffs could be imposed on imports with some countries from some countries in just a matter of weeks. Now, of course, this is on top of the president's earlier orders imposing taxes on imported steel and aluminum and additional tariffs on products from China. Other countries have promised to retaliate, and Chad Bound says that raises the threat of a costly tit-for-tat trade war.
If the United States decides to raise its tariff basically just to match another country's tariff, that country doesn't just sit there idle and say, ah, okay, that's the new world, we'll agree to that. They will then raise their tariff even further. And then you see sort of an unwinding, unraveling of international trade that's going to be tough not only for the United States economy, but potentially for the global economy as well.
And we saw that in the last century when the Smoot-Hawley tariff sparked a global trade war that is widely considered to have made the Great Depression worse. That history lesson, though, does not seem to have swayed the president's thinking.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
More Trump administration news now. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the president's controversial choice to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, was confirmed by the Senate today. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin watched the vote. She is with me now. Hi, Selena.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So this is interesting because there was a moment when it looked like Kennedy might not have the votes to get confirmed. In fact, several weeks where I think it's fair to say it wasn't clear he had the votes. Give us a recap.
Yeah, so a big question mark was what Senator Bill Cassidy was going to do. He is a Republican representing Louisiana. He is also a physician, and he chairs the Senate's Committee on Health. He was clearly uncomfortable with Kennedy's decades of espousing conspiracy theories about the safety of vaccines. But in the end, he came around. You know, he got Kennedy to agree to some maybe limits on how he would address vaccines in this post. And the final tally in the vote was 52 to 48. All Democrats voted against Kennedy. They even held the Senate floor last night, making speeches about their opposition until past midnight. Mm. And all Republicans supported him except for one.
Yeah, and that was Mitch McConnell.
Exactly. So Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the former majority leader, the reason for this no vote was personal for McConnell. He released a statement saying he was a survivor of childhood polio. He has seen vaccines save millions of lives around the world in his lifetime. And then he added, quote, "I will not condone the relitigation of proven cures."
There were also efforts, serious efforts, Selena, to block Kennedy from outside Congress.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were petitions from thousands of doctors warning that he would endanger Americans' health. His cousin, Caroline Kennedy, wrote this scathing letter saying he was unfit and describing sordid things that he had done. And, you know, more than $1 million was also spent on ads, both from the political right because of his past support of abortion rights and from the left because of his decades of espousing conspiracy theories on, you know, vaccines, as we've talked about, but also HIV and Lyme disease and Wi-Fi and all these other things. So it was a close vote, as we said, but in the end, he did make it through.
He made it through. And now he will preside over an agency, which is one of the biggest in the federal government, right? The HHS.
Oh, indeed. It is enormous. It has a budget of $1.7 trillion with a T, which is about the GDP of Australia. It also has 90,000 employees across the health agencies. And those agencies include the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And those two health insurance programs cover 140 million Americans.
So give us a quick preview of what to watch for. What will you be watching for in his first days, weeks in office?
I mean, things are moving really fast in this presidential administration, so we kind of maybe have to watch multiple things at once. But one big question is, what are Elon Musk's plans for the health agencies? He's been dramatically reshaping the federal government since Inauguration Day. The CDC has been in Republican crosshairs for years. Since the COVID pandemic, there have already been issues with websites and data sets going dark there. House Republicans have announced their intention to dramatically cut Medicaid, and biomedical research is another big target for cuts potentially. And then finally, there are just so many questions about how Kennedy manages vaccines in this job, research, recommendations, outside advisors, and more.
Thank you, Selena.
Thank you.
And Pierre Selena Simmons-Duffin.
And now to the remote Aleutian Islands in the Bering Sea off the coast of Alaska. About a decade ago, people living there noticed something was missing. A once abundant seabird seemed to be vanishing. Now, wildlife researchers say they witnessed something unprecedented. Sophia Stewart-Rossi reports from member station KUCB.
On a gray, cloudy day, waves crash against a rocky beach on the island of Unalaska. Megan Dean grips her binoculars against the chilly sea breeze, counting birds bobbing in the bay.
1, 2, 3, 4.
She's making sure she adds them all up before they dive underwater.
10 more black scoters. Have a couple of cormorants.
Dean is part of the National Audubon Society's annual Christmas bird count. Volunteers across the country document every bird they spot in their local area. It helps scientists track changes in bird populations.
Is that just to get out in the winter and like have a greater purpose? A good citizen science project to get you through the dark day.
Unalaska is a birder's paradise, home to species like bald eagles, tufted puffins, and rosy finches. But a notable bird has been missing the past few years, the common murre, a medium-sized black and white seabird with a long pointed bill. Not a single common murre was spotted in Unalaska's Christmas bird count this winter, which is alarming because locals used to count hundreds, sometimes even thousands of them, just before 2013. They're crucial for cycling nutrients through the Bering Sea. Susie Golodoff compiles Unalaska's annual Christmas bird count and has spent nearly 50 years observing the island's birds.
Sometimes you see small populations of birds that become more and more vulnerable and they become extinct. And you can sort of see how that would happen. But when a bird like a murre is hit, I mean, you know something's really haywire in the big picture.
Alaska is known to be home to 8 million common murres across the state, a quarter of the species' world population. But that's not the case anymore. Godoff says the common murre started washing up on beaches all over Alaska.
You know, people who picked up these birds and started examining them, they could see that these murres were starving. They were just starved, emaciated.
People were even noticing that the seabirds were following rivers to inland Alaska looking for food. They got in touch with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where Heather Renner is a biologist.
People are on the ground living with these wildlife, living close to them, and that information from the people who live near them is really urgent.
Renner and other experts look back at 50 years of data from both researchers and citizen scientists. They pieced together their findings and in December published their findings. It was the largest single-species wildlife die-off ever documented. She says the discovery felt like a gut punch.
I think as a scientist, really one of the most striking pieces was how swift the loss was. What that implies, the catastrophes that can happen in our changing world.
The culprit, climate change. Researchers concluded that a 2014 heat wave in the waters of the North Pacific Ocean, known as the Blob, disrupted the common murre's food web. It created a catastrophic rippling effect, causing 4 million common murres to starve to death within just a couple of years. Scientists expect heat waves like the Blob to happen again in the future, meaning more birds could be in danger. If that happens again, bird watchers like Megan Dean and her young daughter will probably notice.
Hey, Mo, do you want to see if there's any birds in all this trash down here?
Now Unalaskans are keeping an eye out for the common raven, a bird that has been missing here the past couple of years. For NPR News, I'm Sophia Stewart-Rossi in Unalaska, Alaska.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. On the second day of his visit with NATO, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had to explain what he said on the first day. Allies were especially concerned that President Trump had held a phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin to push for a peace deal with Ukraine without notifying European countries. Terry Schultz was at NATO headquarters. She's here now. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Mary Louise.
I gather there may be some evolution in what Defense Secretary Hegseth is saying about President Trump's plan on Ukraine.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. As you mentioned, Pete Hegseth gave a really extensive press conference at the end of his 2 days of talks with NATO allies that were focused mostly on Ukraine. And he was peppered with questions about what happened on the first day, about President Trump's announcement that he expects these peace talks to begin imminently. So yesterday, Hegseth said Ukraine would basically have to accept that it wasn't going to get the territory back that Russia has illegally seized, and that it wasn't going to be assured of NATO membership by any possible peace negotiations. Today, Hegseth described things a bit differently.
These negotiations are led by President Trump. Everything is on the table in his conversations with Vladimir Putin and Zelensky. What he decides to allow or not allow is at the purview of the leader of the free world, of President Trump. So I'm not going to stand at this podium and declare what President Trump will do or won't do, what will be in or what will be out, what concessions will be made or what concessions are not made.
But allies felt like yesterday that is, in fact, what Hegseth did. So they're a bit confused and wondering what exactly lies in stores with this process led by Washington. And I can only imagine that's even more acute for the Ukrainians.
Tell me more, Terry, about what you're actually hearing from European NATO members as they react to Trump's initiative in calling Putin and then President Zelensky of Ukraine, but so far as we know, without any coordination with NATO.
Yeah, we don't think they talked to any European leaders here before those phone calls, and that hasn't gone over very well, especially when coupled with the fact that Hegseth emphasized it would be the Europeans who have to support any potential ceasefire, financially, militarily, and physically with a peacekeeping force. So here are a couple reactions I'll share with you, the first one being from the German defense minister, Boris Pistorius. Now, as you know well, Germany is often accused of being reluctant to support Ukraine, or at least being slow to do it. Mm-hmm. Hegseth called Trump the world's best negotiator, but listen to how Pistorius assessed the president's tactics.
Bedauerlich ist, und das sage ich auch, gehört zur Wahrheit dazu.
What is regrettable, and I say this is part of it, is that the Trump administration has already made public concessions to Putin before negotiations have even begun. In my view, it would have been better to discuss Ukraine's possible NATO membership or the country's possible loss of territory at the negotiating table and not to take it off the table beforehand.
So the other really prominent criticism today came from the European Union side of things, EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas, who was invited to part of the defense ministers' meeting. And she warned the U.S. they can't make any agreement stick without their European allies.
It is clear that any deal behind our backs will not work. Any agreement will need also Ukraine and Europe being part of it. And this is clear that appeasement also always fails.
So she went so far as to say that any quick fix is a dirty deal.
Terry Schultz there in Brussels reporting on an alliance that likes to see itself as united behind the same values. Sounds like that was a hard sell this week. Terry Schultz, thank you.
You're welcome.
Saturday Night Live is celebrating its 50 years of sketch comedy and screwball characters, from the Coneheads to Kate McKinnon's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Of course, it takes dozens of people backstage to bring those characters to life with wigs, costumes, and makeup. NPR's Elizabeth Blair spent some time with SNL's head makeup designer Louis Zakarian, who has been on the show for 30 years.
When you hear makeup designer, you might be thinking mascara, blush, and lipstick, but there's also fake noses and bald caps. Louisa Carrion works with all of it.
This is Bowen's Krampus makeup.
His lab at SNL Studios does have barbershop-type chairs and mirrors, but it's also something of a Halloween-style shrine to SNL characters.
This is a silicone prosthetic. It's very soft and fleshy.
Prosthetics that have been used on the show are everywhere. There's Will Ferrell's Devil from 1999. Kate McKinnon's Blobfish Mermaid.
We live on the seafloor, deep in the Mariana Trench. Yep. Made only of gelatin, hence my slick sheen.
Fred Armisen's head that split open in half. This was the Mikey Day one that splits in half.
Oh, look out!
What?
Zakarian says typically the SNL writers come to him on Wednesdays with ideas for that week's show, like having Kyle Mooney play the bright green, big-eared Baby Yoda.
When they came to me, they said, okay, we want Kyle to be Baby Yoda, but, you know, it's got to be still cute.
I mean, I'm just a baby.
Like, every time we make a Baby Yoda, there's three that we build, one for dress, one for air, and one in case of an accident.
Zakarian shows me another room in his makeup lab.
So this is
Oh, wow.
This is the mold room.
The mold room is filled with hundreds of plaster heads.
In this room is like 50 years of SNL history. Every cast member's life cast is in here. These are all current cast, former cast.
Those casts of the cast are what the makeup designers use to sculpt the prosthetics of SNL characters. The process for making them used to be time-consuming. Actors would have to sit while makeup designers covered them in a silicone substance. But during COVID, Zakarian figured out a way to simplify the process using 3D printers.
Now they come in and we do a 3D scan and then put them on these machines in the back here and 3D print their faces right there. And no more goop, no more claustrophobic feelings. It takes 5 minutes instead of 30 minutes. It's been a game changer.
A game changer because speed is everything on Saturday Night Live. Zakarian and his team have 1 to 2 days to whip up the prosthetics, and they need to make sure they can come on and off in minutes between sketches, basically the duration of a commercial break.
It's just a flurry of hands. We don't stop. That's one of my things. I zone out and don't talk much when I'm in doing my makeup.
Well, there is one word, he says.
There's a lot of I'm sorry, especially as we're peeling things off when there's no time. I'm sorry.
It's absolutely bonkers. I don't understand how they do it.
Kate McKinnon is one of the many cast members who have turned to Louis Zakarian for help with the look of a character.
Louis just loves what he does, and he is an artist, and he just can do it 10,000 times faster than anybody else and better. And I adore him.
Zakarian says he thrives on what he calls the controlled mayhem of Saturday Night Live. His first professional makeup job was at a community theater near his home in Queens, New York. He was still a teenager. He says his parents weren't too keen on him pursuing a career in the arts, so he almost became a police officer.
They took the exams and I was a couple of weeks away from going into the police academy, and I got a call to work on a TV show.
Eventually, in 1995, he made it to his dream job.
As soon as that music starts on Saturday night, I get the butterflies. It's been 30 years now, and I still get the butterflies and still get antsy.
A who's who of Saturday Night Live alumni will appear on the 50th anniversary special airing on Sunday. Makeup designer Louis Zakarian will have worked with just about all of them. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
4 years ago, a power failure in Texas left millions of people freezing in their homes for days. More than 200 people died.
And because our system kind of broke down in the cold right as demand skyrocketed.
After electricity was restored, state leaders vowed to make sure it would never happen again. What's changed since then? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, a team of Brazilian scientists is studying the brains of whales and dolphins.
I want to do this kind of research here. I want to inspire Brazilian people to do something new, to do something special.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Federal workers are starting to receive layoff notices as the Trump administration moves ahead with plans to drastically downsize the government. NPR's Shannon Bond reports many of the first cuts are targeting employees who were recently hired and still on probationary status.
Some probationary staff at the Department of Education received notices they were being terminated effective immediately, according to employees who spoke with NPR on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal. At the General Services Administration, many recently hired employees were called into meetings late Wednesday and told they were being let go. The cuts come days after President Trump signed an executive order directing federal agencies to start preparing to, quote, initiate large-scale reductions in force. Trump and his advisor Elon Musk say they are slashing what they say is excessive government spending. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
President Trump is introducing a plan to impose broad new tariffs on global trading partners. The order covers taxes that other countries place on goods from the United States. Trump argues his plan would level the playing field between U.S. manufacturers and foreign competitors. But NPR's Scott Horsley says it might not be that simple.
The White House is sending mixed signals. One argument that the administration is making is that these tariffs are a short-term tactic to get other companies to open their markets up to U.S. exports. Trump has also talked about using tariffs as a way to raise money for the government and possibly offset some of the cost of the tax cuts he also hopes to pass. The thing is, tariffs can't really do both those things.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley reporting. Stocks closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow was up 342 points at the close. The Nasdaq Composite also traded higher, up 295. This is NPR. A judge in South Texas is ordering an election to decide whether to incorporate Elon Musk's SpaceX Starship launch site as a new Texas city. Texas Public Radio's Mariana Navarro has more.
The general manager of Starbase has said creating a new Texas city would make it easier to build amenities for SpaceX employees and others living near the SpaceX launch site. SpaceX filed a petition in December to local officials asking to make Starbase an incorporated territory. Cameron County Judge Eddie Trevino says the petition met all statutory requirements and was signed by at least 10% of qualified voters as required by law. The election will be held during the general May 3rd election in Brownsville. If approved, Starbase would be a Type C Texas municipality, which has less than 5,000 residents and functions with a mayor and two commissioners. I'm Marianne Navarro in San Antonio.
The acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York has quit. The resignation of Danielle Sassoon comes just days after the Justice Department ordered her to drop the criminal corruption case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Sassoon is a veteran prosecutor who helped convict Sam Bankman-Fried, the founder of the now bankrupt cryptocurrency exchange FTX. Sassoon was appointed interim U.S. attorney by the Trump administration last month. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station.
And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners and detainees have been freed from Israeli jails these past few weeks. That's in exchange for the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas in Gaza. It's part of the fragile ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Many of those Palestinians were released to their families in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. And they allege harassment, arrests, and intimidation by Israel. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
The Zuchayer house is at the end of a long residential street in East Jerusalem. On the morning we visit, kids are running around. It's full of family. We're here to see 47-year-old Ashraf Zuchayer, who was recently released after 23 years in Israeli jail.
I feel I will born again.
He was arrested in 2002 for being a member of Hamas and driving a suicide bomber to an attack on a Tel Aviv bus. Six people were killed. He was sentenced to 600 years in jail. Ashraf said when he heard he would be released.
Tell me, that's dream or truth?
When he got released, members of his family immediately rushed him home, where his parents were waiting for him.
That's the best moment in my life, yeah.
His mom had cooked a big meal, and people from all around the neighborhood gathered. But the celebration was short-lived.
2 hours after that, soldiers of the Israeli occupation forced my house.
Israeli forces raided the house, guns raised, according to the family and several New York Times journalists who were there covering it. They forced people, including children, to the floor. They arrested Ashraf's brother. They came back 2 days later and arrested 12 more members of the Zuchayer family. The Israeli police told NPR they were arrested for, quote, involvement in a recent demonstration supporting a terrorist. A police report says they were waving Hamas flags and shot off a gun. The family denies that. Ashraf says his relatives tried to argue, saying they were celebrating Ashraf's release because he's family, not because he's Hamas. Israel says such celebrations encourage violence and terrorism and has long discouraged them. And the government has been especially adamant about it during this ceasefire deal, banning them. But Palestinians say the rules are ambiguous and that the ban is an intimidation tactic.
The Israelis play some silly games.
Qadura Faris is the head of the Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Commission, the official Palestinian group that deals with detainees. He says what happened at the Zuchayer house is an extreme case, but it fits a wider pattern.
In all the villages, all the refugee camps, the Shabak phoned the family.
That's Israel's internal security agency. Faris says released detainees and their families get frequent phone calls reminding them not to celebrate. The security agency, also known as Shin Bet, did not respond to NPR's request for comment. And Faris points out,
Israel continue arrested as part of their strategy.
Israeli forces are still arresting Palestinians in the West Bank on a daily basis, especially since it launched a major operation there just as this ceasefire deal went into effect. So even as hundreds of Palestinians have been released from Israeli jails in recent weeks, hundreds more have been arrested or detained during that time. And
those that they released, they could rearrest them again.
Dozens of those released in the first ceasefire deal back in 2023 were later rearrested and four killed by Israeli forces. Fedra says it's a way of keeping former detainees and their families on their toes. In a small Palestinian village outside of Ramallah, Rudania and her nephew Hamid welcome us to their family home. We're not using their last names because they tell us they've been threatened by Israeli forces and they fear for their safety. Rudania's brother, Hamid's uncle, is soon to be released after 16 years in Israeli jail on charges of being affiliated with Hamas. Hamid says Israeli soldiers were just at the house a few hours ago. He says the soldiers told them that if the family celebrates, they'll raid the house and arrest anyone who participated. Rudania says it all has the family on edge. As we're talking, another member of the family pokes their head into the living room and says word has spread that the Israeli military is at another house down the street. Rudenia keeps getting up to look out the window nervously. Maybe after you leave, she says, the soldiers will come back. We pack up and head out, just as one, two, three armored military jeeps waving the Israeli flag drive by the house and continue down the street. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News in the occupied West Bank.
We turn now to big news out of the Justice Department. The interim U.S. attorney in Manhattan and two senior prosecutors in Washington have resigned. Their resignations are tied to the decision by the Trump Justice Department to drop the corruption case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is covering all of this and joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Okay, I realize this news just broke this afternoon. What are you hearing so far?
So first off, the acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, Danielle Sassoon, has resigned. She's a veteran prosecutor with a conservative legal pedigree. She clerked, for example, for the Supreme Court Justice, the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who, of course, is a legal icon on the right. The Trump administration had tapped Sassoon to lead the U.S. attorney's office in Manhattan last month on an interim basis. But then 3 days ago, the acting number two official in the Trump Justice Department, Emil Bove, directed her in a memo to drop the corruption case against Eric Adams, the New York City mayor. Now, Bove said in his memo that this decision wasn't based on the evidence in the case. Instead, he alleges that the case against Adams, who is a Democrat, was politically motivated, even though it was brought during the Biden administration. The memo also says the case should be dropped because it interferes with Adams' ability to help the Trump administration with immigration enforcement. Now, it is highly unusual for department leadership to interfere like this in a case. Former prosecutors say that it's shocking. Sassoon says in a letter to the attorney general that the law doesn't support dropping the case. She cannot in good faith move to do so, and so she has decided to quit over it.
Wow. Okay. Has the Justice Department said anything about any of this?
The Justice Department I contacted, they did not respond, but I did obtain an eight-page letter from Bove to Sassoon in which he says that he accepts her resignation. He also accuses her of losing sight of her oath by suggesting that she has the discretion to interpret the Constitution in a way that is inconsistent with the policies of the Attorney General and a democratically elected president. Now, in this letter, Bove also says that two of the prosecutors who worked the Eric Adams case are being placed on leave. He says that those two prosecutors and Sassoon will be investigated by the Office of the Attorney General and the department's internal unit that handles allegations of misconduct. Just an aside here, one of those line prosecutors is a U.S. Army veteran and a winner of two Bronze Stars.
Okay, so practically speaking, what happens to the Adams case now?
Well, Bove says in his letter that the case is being taken over by the Justice Department and it will move to dismiss the prosecution in court. But there's pushback to that move as well. Sources tell me and our colleague Carrie Johnson that the Adams case was reassigned to the Public Integrity Section at the Justice Department here in Washington. The acting head of that section, John Keller, and his supervisor, Kevin Driscoll, both resigned today instead of taking on the Adams case. And that gives you a sense of the pushback from within the Justice Department to this, again, highly unusual effort by the Trump Department leadership to insert itself into this case to try to get it dropped. In the legal world, I have to say, this is a very big deal, and there may, of course, be more ripple effects to come.
Very big deal indeed. That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
President Trump has ignited a political firestorm in South Africa by offering refugee status to Afrikaners there. This comes after a series of false claims from his administration that the white minority in South Africa is facing, quote, rights violations. The episode has infuriated many in South Africa, but some are seeing the funny side, as Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
USA, USA, USA.
It's an executive order that spawned 1,000 South African videos on TikTok.
Hey, dude, what's up? I'm moving to the USA, bro.
Okay, why?
Because I just got refugee status, son.
Okay, don't talk like that, okay?
This is one of many comedic videos that have gone viral in South Africa after Trump issued an executive order late last week offering refugee status to Afrikaners, quote, escaping government-sponsored race-based discrimination. Trump has accused the South African government of engaging in land grabs after it passed a controversial land reform law this year. The law is aimed at addressing past inequalities, but no land has been seized. The South African government responded it was, quote, ironic that Trump was giving refugee status to a, quote, economically privileged group.
We have to state categorically, we don't want to move elsewhere.
Thanks, but no thanks, said Kelly Creel from Afroforum. The Afrikaner group have been actively lobbying the U.S. government about the inequalities they claim Afrikaners face here. Afrikaners are the white descendants of mainly Dutch colonists.
We also have to make sure that our culture is transferred to future generations, and that cannot be done abroad.
White people, who make up about 7% of the population, still own some 72% of private farmland.
Your voice. Your station.
The response in South Africa ranged from humor to anger to incredulity.
Okay, so we now have an executive order issued against our country.
That's media personality Clement Magnatela on his 702 radio show.
An executive order whose foundational premise lacks factual accuracy and just simply fails to recognize and acknowledge the country's painful history of colonialism and apartheid.
Outside a mall in Johannesburg, restaurant manager Sarah said Trump's actions could have serious repercussions for race relations in South Africa.
Trump has brought division in the country. We were in the process of healing, and now, I mean, we are reliving the apartheid era. It just opens up that wound, you know.
Both she and her husband Miles are black South Africans. Neither wanted to share their surnames due to the racial sensitivities of this issue in the country. But Miles thinks Trump's South African-born advisor has had an influence.
I think Elon Musk is the one who's feeding all those news and all the things.
Since Trump's announcement, the South African Chamber of Commerce in the U.S. said their email server crashed this week after tens of thousands of inquiries about refugee status.
We do not have any idea regarding the details of it. That is now up to the Trump administration to clarify.
That's Afroforum's Aaron Sprutz.
As far as Afroforum can see, none such a process has yet been put in place.
But for this one Afrikaner farmer, the thought of leaving is too much.
All I can say is that Donald Trump must leave his things in America and we can stay in South Africa. So, yeah.
Ruan Krokamp told local broadcaster ENCA he would like to go to America, but only for a short while.
Yeah, I'll maybe go take a holiday there, but I won't go to stay there.
For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump has named his choice to lead the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. That agency plays a huge role in permitting and developing energy projects across the country. Colorado Public Radio's Caitlin Kim reports that Trump's choice is a petroleum industry lobbyist from Denver.
For a president who's vowed to drill, baby, drill, Kathleen Scama is not a surprising pick to lead the BLM, which manages resources on 245 million acres of public lands. Since 2006, she's helmed the Western Energy Alliance, an association of independent oil and natural gas companies with interests on public lands. The BLM director requires Senate confirmation, and Scama's got fans there, including Wyoming Senator Cynthia Lummis. She calls Scama an inspired pick.
She's so knowledgeable about the West, about the oil and gas industry, about public lands, about permitting.
Scama was a contributor to the Interior Department section of Project 2025, and her group was part of a lawsuit against the Biden administration over a rule that put conservation on equal footing with other uses of public lands, from grazing and recreation to mining. Last month, she told Colorado Public Radio she expects Trump's energy policies to closely align with her industry's priorities.
Moving forward with lease sales, moving forward with permitting on federal lands, moving forward with completing environmental analysis.
Scama would work under new Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, who's pursuing the administration's push for industry deregulation in line with Trump's executive orders.
They're saying, agencies, look at your regulations, do what you need to do to adjust those regulations so that they are not an impediment to American energy.
Environmental groups have come out against Scama's nomination. Aaron Weiss is with the Center for Western Priorities.
The BLM director is in charge of multiple use, and Kathleen Sagama has demonstrated over and over and over again that she believes oil and gas drilling is the primary and best use of America's public lands.
During his first term, the Republican-controlled Senate chose not to vote on President Trump's nominee to lead the Bureau of Land Management, William Perry Penley. He was a controversial choice and served in an acting capacity until a federal judge ordered him to step aside. For NPR News, I'm Caitlin Kim.
Picture this. You're on a boat racing to your island destination. You grab your tools and swim ashore, and you make it in time to extract the brain from the dead humpback whale before you. This is what happened to Brazilian neuroscientist Camila Souza a year and a half ago.
You look at the situation and you say, okay, I need it. I'll get this one no matter what. You cannot think, you just have to go.
Souza is fixated on finding whale and dolphin brains along the Brazilian coastline. Science reporter Ari Daniel visited her to understand why.
So there's a van that just arrived with a special delivery?
I would say yes. It's a dolphin that's stranded in a beach.
This is Camila Souza. She's bedecked in marine mammal jewelry.
Because people know that I like dolphins.
And until recently, before taking time off for a short fellowship at Oxford, she was the scientific director here at the Orca Institute, a conservation organization in Vitória in southeastern Brazil. They tend to any marine mammal that strands along their section of the coast and either rehabilitate and return it to the water if it's alive. Or, as is the case with this deceased Guiana dolphin being hoisted into the air, bring it back to their facility.
We are going to analyze all the organs of this animal and to investigate the cause of the death.
With an eye towards preventing similar deaths in the future, often due to entanglement with fishing gear or loud underwater noises that cause the animals to surface too quickly. But ever since she was a little girl, Souza's had her eye on a particular part of an animal like this one.
I think about the brain.
You think about the brain.
It's like Alice in Wonderland. Give me the head.
Souza says there's very little known about the brains of whales and dolphins living in the waters off Central and South America. Mapping how those brains are wired up can teach scientists about the behavior and adaptations of these animals. In addition,
dolphins have Alzheimer's, encephalitis, meningitis. So it's an opportunity to understand diseases that can also affect humans.
For all these reasons, Soz is intent on studying cetacean brains from this part of the world, and she's making real progress. She points to the suspended Guiana dolphin, a species whose behavior is well described.
But studies about the brain, we didn't have. So we published the first brain description for this species.
Soza and her colleagues used an MRI to describe the neuroanatomy of the Guiana dolphin that washed ashore west of Rio, which was a real achievement for reasons that soon become clear. Soza takes me to the necropsy room. The vets sharpened their knives to dissect another dolphin, a female that recently stranded. Soza brings me around to the head.
So here we have the skull. There is no brain.
Okay, it's liquefied.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point. We need to have a fresh carcass.
And that's a challenge in a big country like Brazil. The heat accelerates decomposition. Minutes matter. Which means sometimes Soza has to extract the brain from an animal right on the beach.
We have to deal with people, animals, the weather.
But Soza's relentless. And whenever the conditions do conspire in her favor, she gets another brain. I follow her next door to her office. This is definitely a refrigerator filled with brains.
It's the largest collection of cetacean brains from Latin America.
In this fridge alone, she's got a brain from a pygmy sperm whale, various dolphin species, and more. She lifts a brain out of the largest plastic container. It's from that baby humpback she swam ashore to dissect, and it's twice the size of a human brain.
So this brain is huge. I need the two hands to hold this brain.
Wow. There before me is arguably the convoluted essence of a humpback whale, the thing that lets it swim and sing and so much more.
It was the first extraction of a whale brain here in Brazil.
Given all she's accomplished, Soza says she'd be a plum pick to be hired abroad.
But I want to do this kind of research here. I want to inspire Brazilian people to do something new, to do something special.
People like her PhD student, Hitor Minsing, who's developing a fancy tool to model the cetacean brain in 3D.
We don't have to always rely on other countries. We can actually do it on our own and show the world that we can actually do good science.
My last stop is a nearby stretch of beach. Soza looks out at the ocean and considers the trajectory that brought her to this moment.
I think that I did the right thing because I'm super happy with my work and with the things that I'm doing for my country and for me as a researcher.
Soza says that little girl she used to be would be happy. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.